Welcome, welcome. You are listening to their podcast, Two Massage Therapists and a Microphone. His name is Mark. He's a registered massage therapist, registered kinesiologist here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And they've got a real cool guest sitting on the couch today. And for once, it isn't me.
It's not Nikki. Literally, she's on the couch, but she's not going to be mic'd for the rest
of
the episode.
She's the reason why the real cool guest is here.
Yeah, Nikki brought us some real cool guests. We actually have a room full of people, but, you know, mic shy, camera shy people. Only one brave soul, Ken, is mic'd today.
Camera shy doesn't work, because if you can see yourself on this screen.
Yeah, you're on camera.
You want a camera.
We've got Amy beside me, who's not going to be mic'd, and that's okay. But she's here for moral support and photography and those kinds of things. So Ken is here because Nikki thought it'd be cool to talk to him about a few things. One of the cool things is the fact that Ken is an illusionist. And if any of you know Mark even a little bit, you know all of this kind of stuff just fascinates him.
A little bit.
Not that I'm not fascinated by it, but I'm like a little kid who believes in all the things. Like you show me something and you're like, look what I did. I'm like, wow, amazing. Mark's like, how did you do it? I want to learn. I want to learn more. I'm like, cool. Show me more.
I walked into a conversation about gambling, and you're not allowed in casinos. Why are you not allowed in casinos? You count cards? Is that what's happening?
So there's a couple classifications for what I do. So one is a card mechanic.
Okay.
And that's basically the professional study of how to cheat at playing cards.
Right.
So any good card trick you've ever seen in your life, the original concept and technique was designed way back in the day by a gambling cheater of some kind.
Yeah.
And these guys eventually released their ideas, and magicians stole the ideas to perform better magic. And if you know what I know when it comes to gambling and playing cards and cheating, and the casino knows who you are.
How does a casino know who you are, though?
So I've been around.
Right.
I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
There's an interesting story about how they found out who I was. It was at Casino Rama. This is probably a really good venue to tell the story. We were doing a show up in Casino Rama.
And does this involve Kevin Spacey at all?
No, this involves the OPP.
Okay,
security.
I say that for anyone that's listening. If you haven't seen that movie,
you should. Absolutely.
Right? I don't remember the name of the movie.
21.
21.
You're right.
All right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Continue.
So there was we were doing a show, and I had it was a very small show. It was just a walk around kind of show. So I had a few things in this one shoulder strap bag. Went to Casino Rama, and we got an ice cream, and then went back to catch the bus on the way back to Toronto and realized I forgot my bag on the bench. Mm. Went back to where the bag was, and there was no bag, but there was all these women sitting there and a security guard taking notes. Ooh. And I'm like, what's going on? Have you guys seen a bag? And they all point to the security guard. And he's like, is that your bag?
Depends who's asking.
Right. And he's like, yeah. He's like, so then I hear my description over his radio.
Oh.
I'm like, this can't be good. So then next thing I know, 30, 45 seconds later, I was surrounded by security. There's a truck that pulls up, an SUV, more security. This really big guy in a suit goes, is that your bag? I'm like, let's maybe define if this is the same bag. He's like, well, describe your bag. So I described the bag, and sure enough, it was the same bag. He's like, get in the truck. Hmm. I have no idea what's going on. We get in the truck.
Are you like anxious, scared now?
Yeah, I'm just,
was this the first time in a truck?
No. No, okay. No, it was just a regular SUV, but it was packed with security and cops. I had no idea what was going on.
Okay. Jesus.
And little did I know, the head of the OPP, they have an office inside the back of the casino. I didn't know this. And so they drive me back. And then by the time we get out of the truck, there's a side door. There's a long corridor, which is all casino staff. And then there's more security and more OPP. And they're literally shuffling me down this hallway, but they're not getting within 3 feet of me for whatever reason. I know it was really, really ridiculous. So then they're pushing everyone else out of the way, and then there's more security. By the time we can finally get to the OPP office, about 20 to 30 guys, all being very tough and not answering any questions.
20 to 30 guys. Okay, yeah. You guys can't see
wait,
but it's not like he's this massive, terrifying looking
right.
guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You got 20 to 30 security on you.
Have you had run-ins with the law before?
No.
So this is your first like real run-in with the law?
Yeah, it was stupid shit when you were a kid, but nothing serious.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, not, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be shitting my pants. I'd be like, what the fuck's going on?
Well, I was curious. That's what I was curious.
I'd be scared.
I didn't know what was going on, so we finally get to the head of OPP, and the guy's there at the desk. He's like, come this way. He goes, ID. So I show him my ID, and he goes, all right, so this is what's going to happen. The bomb squad's on its way.
Ooh.
We're going to blow up your bag.
What?
I'm like, whoa, guys, take it easy. I'm an illusionist. I'm a performer. I know some of the items that are in my bag are suspicious if you don't know what they are, but there's no bombs. I promise you there's no bombs. If you just show me where the bag is, I'll show you what's going on.
Yeah, okay.
And the guy goes,
we're going to give the bomb guy his bag back.
That's what they did. He goes, your bag's in that room. So I go into the bag. I go to the room. The door was open. So I go, I see the bag. I'm perfect. So I grab the bag. I put it on the desk and I open the zipper. And the moment I went to open the zipper.
A dove flies out.
No. All the security took three steps back.
Yeah.
Like they literally thought I was going to blow up the casino or something.
But yet they still let you open the bag.
Right. Yeah, so they were very curious about one little thing in my bag. Anyway, so I opened it up. I showed them what it was. I had to expose the secret so they knew what the hell it was. And the moment I did that, all these tough, really big guys were like, oh, my God, that's amazing. Oh, can you do my kid's party? Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It was so for the next 20, 30 minutes, I'm performing in the head office of the OPP at Casinorama. Missed my bus. I had to get she was still on the bus, so I had to meet her in Barrie, which is part of the route back to Toronto. And I'm like, guys, this has been fun, but, you know, I got to pick up my wife. He's like, oh, don't worry about that. We'll get Larry to take care of it. Like, who the hell is Larry? So they got it because just meet Larry out front. All right, so I get my stuff. I go out front, and sure enough, Larry pulled up in a limo and took me all the way to pick up her and take me all the way to downtown Toronto. It was great.
It was
so
wild.
Yeah, so since then, they know who I am, but it's a private business, and they don't want to let people that know what I know.
Yeah.
They don't have to let me play.
Were you like a little bit disappointed that you had to let these like big scary dudes in on the secret?
No.
All I was thinking of
Barney Stinson.
Magician's code.
Yeah.
No, well, I think the code will allow you not to get arrested if you yep. really like, especially a bomb threat. Like that's terrorist level kind of stuff. I don't want anything to do with that. But these guys were very funny at the end. And like, yeah, you're never allowed in here again. It was great. But I'm not into gambling. So
I feel like that
matter.
Was a good introduction. But we should maybe like properly introduce Ken too.
I have a buddy whose cousin. And counts cards.
Yep.
And he can't go anywhere. He can't go to Vegas. He can't go here. He can't go there.
If you wanted to, you have to disguise himself or change something because they know who you are.
I've always wanted to do this with someone that plays cards really well. Because I'm all about fast money. I'm happy to get fast money. And I want to say, here's $5,000. Mm. Just go double my money. And whatever you make on top of it, I don't care. Just bring me back 10. Perfect. Is that a stupid investment?
No, I mean, it depends on what you're playing. If you're playing poker or roulette, those are the only two good games that you can play. One, you're not playing the house for poker. And roulette in Europe, you have 13% better odds of winning than roulette in North America because of the double zero.
Hmm.
But if you know what you're doing, those are really the only two games. Anything else is a waste of your time.
So you want to know what I heard? I heard my husband say, is it a bad idea to give somebody $5,000 and gamble it? And I heard Ken say, it's a horrible idea. That's all I heard.
That's not what
okay?
I heard
That's
at
all.
All
I heard.
It's either you bring it back double or you just bring me back my money.
Tomato,
that's all.
Tomato. I mean, you know... I'm only the medium here.
All right, let's do a proper.
Let's do a proper introduction. So aside from the fact that he's an illusionist, which I feel like we're going to talk most about, I think Nikki was also saying that you've been navigating a very rare syndrome that you had a diagnosis of, which we'll talk about. By the way, I had to learn how to say it. I don't even think I know how. Guillain-Barré,
yeah.
I can say it. Guillain.
Yeah, Guillain-Barré.
Yeah. That's been like my nemesis since massage school. I'm like, I can't say this. You want to know something? I'm French-Canadian too. Yeah. I should have no problem with this. I cannot say it.
I heard about it. I was like, same thing, but then I figured it out. But yeah, Miller-Fisher is a super rare form of it. It's like one in a million. They get it. There's no like, you know, there's no genetic code that makes you, like you can't get it because of your parents or anything like that. Right. They don't know where it comes from. All they know is it is preceded by an infection of some kind, cough, cold, whatever it is. That's all they know. Really, really fucking scary. Absolutely.
Wow. Well.
Yeah.
For everybody listening, because those were the two reasons that Nikki said, you got to talk to this guy. And I was like, I trust Nikki. She's been on our show 1,700 times.
She brings you wine.
She does the intros. She brings me wine. You know, all the things. Can you give an intro to everybody, like who you are, how long you've been doing what you're doing, now that we know a little bit about you, and when this diagnosis happened, like how long you've been dealing with this very rare condition?
So I think I started magic at 5 years old.
What gets you into magic at five?
So my uncle showed me a trick at like Christmas, you know, just a simple, not a magician, just a simple card trick. And that's what got me hooked. And then I just started going to all the libraries and taking all the magic books I could get until I was 12. And then I figured out where magicians go to get their stuff. And then it just sort of grew from that. But 5 years old, when I started sort of learning, I threw away the first 4 years of my life. And then, I started performing at 12. for corporations. I think my first gig was for Famous Players Theaters back in the day, doing a movie promotion, and had been doing major corporate work for about 25 years.
How do you jump from 5 years old? Someone showed me a card trick, and I get a magic kit that comes with a hat and a cape.
So the next year I got my magic kit for Christmas.
So I'm doing corporate work at 12. How does that go?
A lot of trial and error, actually. I never had a mentor or a teacher. So basically, once I was, once I found out where the magic store was, where the magicians go to get their supplies and their, you know, tapes and DVDs and all this stuff, I basically would spend all my allowance and beg my mother to take me to the store. And then she'd watch me go from the store to the bank machine, to the store, to the bank machine. Cause I would basically just do trial and error until I figured out stuff that worked. Waste of time and money, but it was good because now I teach and I create my own magic to sell to other magicians. So hadn't I not done it that way, I would have done just been like every other magician going through the routines.
That is like true passion, by the way. Yeah. I don't think there's ever been anything in my life where I have that amount of dedication and determination. Like, I am going to do this one way or another. Like, when I hear stories like this, I'm like, you were just meant 100% to do this because no way at like 9 years old. I'm like, all right, take me to this magic show. Like, how do you even figure?
So you didn't have.
You don't look like you're a ton younger than we are.
You didn't,
like, how do you even find out at that time where this magic store is?
You didn't have anything that you were passionate about as a
kid?
That's the only thing you wanted to do? Not even like Lego or something? Like, I wake up and I do Lego.
You already know. You're acting like you haven't known me for a long time. No, nothing.
Is it?
Like, there's
for the rest of you guys in the room?
Do you guys need to step outside?
Because you're witnessing a domestic. Was there any of you guys here? Like, as a kid, you're like so passionate about something that's all you wanted to do?
Wife was into art, graphic design,
Live and breathe it, right? As a kid, okay, cool.
Yeah, like for you, so it was music. Like
maybe I don't know.
I mean,
I don't remember nine.
I mean, in terms of like playing music, you've taught yourself how to play multiple instruments because that's something you're like, I'm gonna figure this out. Yeah. So I'm listening to you, and I'm like, holy crap! Like as a little kid, you figured out like, did you know how to use the internet? And like you're figuring out, right? That's what I'm saying.
This was part of the problem was. I would go to every library I could get my hands on, and I would take out the entire section of magic that they had, return maybe half of them, and just I would learn everything I could, and then I would eventually find books that were, as I said, these texts that were designed by cheats, gamblers, that released methods, and I got to these books, and I was far too inexperienced to understand some of the terminology in them, so it would say certain things and I would have no idea what move it was talking about. So I would have to invent my own move to cover that particular piece of the text, which allowed me to create my own versions of ideas and then create my own ideas. And then that's where a lot of magicians see my work now. And they're like, what's that from? Mm. I'm like, no, that's mine.
Oh.
So when you're going to a shop to get all your gear, to get all the stuff.
Yeah.
Are magic shop people like really encouraging? Is it a positive thing? Are they like, yes?
Have you never been to a magic shop? You've got to go.
No, I've never
They're basically, it's wonder on demand. Yeah. You go in and the hottest, latest thing that they want to demo, they'll demo for you.
Right.
And you can buy it and take it home and show it to, or give it to your kid or whatever you want to do with it. But you know, you spend 50, 60 bucks, you'll get the latest, hottest trick.
So they're super encouraging.
100%.
By the way, we need to introduce our 9-year-old to him. Like this is up her alley. She's getting
really be doing more magic. We were just having this conversation.
Well, yeah, because
like you
really
know when a little
it.
Kid goes into a music store, I'm not gonna lie, sometimes the guitar guy is like, oh, this fucking 9-year-old kid just gonna mess up this fucking Fender. Do you know what I mean? It's not that way.
No, not at all. In fact, it's super encouraging. It's very supportive. It's a bit of a community. They don't. A lot of them don't exist anymore because brick and mortars have sort of died out, and the community unfortunately has kind of subsided to what's left. Because everything's gone online, everything's become online sales and videos and tutorials. Mm. But that wonder place, that place where you can still go and buy and have stuff demoed, they do exist, but they're very far, few and far between. But they are really cool places, and there's awesome stuff you can look at. And there's always, you know, a few magicians hanging out anyway that are more than welcome. Like they'll welcome you, they'll show you stuff. It's great. I love it.
That's really cool.
Sorry, I cut off your question.
I don't even remember now. I'm just listening. Like, oh, okay. This is so cool. But yeah, we have a 9-year-old daughter who she's really interested in magic and she loves illusions.
She's interested
kind of
in anything
stuff.
Performance.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. That's really good. I mean, I started in theater as well when I was in elementary school and high school. I love theater. A trained actor, these kinds of things, which anything helps. And I tell anybody that wants to get into magic, especially if your kids want to get into magic, Do they play an instrument, a piano, guitar, anything that keeps the dexterity going?
She's learning piano. She's perfect. In Elf the Musical at her school. Perfect. Yeah, she's all of this.
Then this is easy. This
so you into theater, were you a triple threat? Can you dance?
No,
can you
sing? I don't do the dancing, but I think the magic makes up for that.
There you go. That is the deal.
I just learned to salsa like last year. So
Are you good?
No.
Do you have to count when you're doing your steps?
So that's the thing.
Like, I look back at his wife and you're like, are you good? Like, is he good?
I could do miracles with my hands. But learning salsa starting the right foot did not work. Until we tried left foot start, then I got it. Mm. I was like, okay. I had no idea that was the problem.
Sometimes Mark tries to teach me salsa in the kitchen, but usually I've already had a few drinks by then, so I'm just stepping on him. I'm like, well, I'm not that good.
We've tried to waltz. Yes. We've tried to foxtrot.
Yeah.
I took ballroom 1 year.
Nice.
Yeah, he tries to teach me ballroom in the kitchen.
In university, fine. In kinesiology or physical education program in university, you have to take a movement.
Sure. Yeah.
You have to. So it was a choice between, like, for me, it was like country line dancing or
I did line dancing in elementary school. Yeah, that was not fun.
I did modern dance because I'm not graceful. And modern dance is like the ugly ballet, right? Ballroom. So it was perfect.
Ballroom's where it's at, man. Ballroom where
it's so
at.
So classic. Yeah. Frames. Yeah. That's good. So a lot of, I guess, a lot of corporate work, and then from there we just recently, in the last couple of years, started doing theater shows, but COVID hit. So
wait, I'm gonna back this up.
Yeah.
Did you finish high school?
Yeah.
Did you do anything after high school?
Yeah. Into school? I studied in 4 or 5 different universities. Basically, I just went and hung out with all my buddies that went to university,
right?
And then sat in on classes, handed in assignments, and basically got fake degrees for sociology, philosophy, world religions, anything where people were involved in discussion.
And the whole time you're doing this stuff, you're just like, I don't want to fucking do this?
No, I didn't see the value in the amount of money being charged for the amount of knowledge and actual practical knowledge I could gain from it.
Right.
So my brother went to university. He did great academically. He was like the brain. And I was the artist. That's how it was in the family. So I think, how could I get more education about the nature of people and how people are around the world. Mm-hmm. I figured this was probably the cheapest way I could do this. I go hang out, party, do magic, get paid to just sit and perform and do classes. And profs were like, do you go here? I'm like, no, I'm just auditing.
Yeah.
He doesn't even go to this school.
I'm answering questions for the prof to other students. And they were like, who the fuck is this guy? So it was good, yeah.
I love that.
That's a movie right there.
So unofficially educated.
Yeah,
I think
that, whoever says, like, listen, whatever your path is in life, great. If you think university is, sure, good, do it. There's more one way to skin a cat, as they say. So I think the way I went down and how I got to go to all these places and meet all these people, and if you drive, 6-7 hours in any direction, people are fundamentally different in wherever you get. Mm-hmm. So the further out you go, the more changes you see in behavior and what how people react to certain things. So that was huge, and I think a lot of people in my industry do not spend time learning about people, which is key. It's not that we're here to fool you, but you can't entertain someone the same if they live different lifestyles. Mm. So that was huge for me. Plus, I got to travel the world doing these shows and stuff. So that was great. And the best thing about magic is there's no language barrier. It's just a visual art form.
Right.
So making something disappear and reappear works in any language. Majority of the world knows what playing cards is and, gambling. And so anything related to that was a real, real easy way to travel the world and make people smile and get paid to do it. It was great.
I dig it.
Yeah. So then COVID happened and all that stopped.
Yeah.
Instantly. Every magician I know and in pretty much North America had no more work like that. It was over.
Yeah.
There was no venues holding anything. And then basically we sat on the couch for about a year, finished Netflix twice. And then out of nowhere.
I've always wanted to say that. I finished Netflix.
During this time when you're finishing Netflix, you're like, what's going to happen here?
Well, the great thing, everyone took some money from the government, whatever. But I spent the first 6 months redoing my office. So you have to understand, like, after years and years of performing, just stuff piles up. Like, you're pretty organized. This was not my lifestyle.
Right.
Going craziness everywhere. So, yelling to my wife, Amy, do you know where that cable is? And she's like, yeah, check under the bin and the thing. Take me half an hour to get to one cable. Yeah. So now I'm like, okay, I got the time. Let me organize. Let me redo my entire office. And I redid it three times, labeled everything. All the wires are wrapped. Everything's hooked. Everything's beautiful now. Now it's seconds in, seconds out. It's all on wheels.
Isn't that a great feeling?
Oh, it's so much better. So redid the office, finished Netflix, you know, fix up the house.
All you needed was a global pandemic.
Yeah, that's all you needed, right? Some time. That's it. Yeah. You know, paint a little bit, clean up here and there. And then I get a call for an audition for Illusionarium. So I don't know if you guys heard of this. Illusionarium was part of the Van Gogh exhibit at One Yonge Street. It was the world's first immersive magic experience. So Penn and Teller were part of it. Jamie Allen was the creator, and he's from the UK. And they figured they needed to put on something. They just didn't know where they could do it.
Right.
So then they realized that Ontario government at that time in 2021, I think it was, were allowing 50 people in a room you know, spaced out per show.
Right.
So what they did is they figured out they could do a room with multiple rooms inside of it, and then you have a timed entrance, and then you go, and then the next group of 50 go, and so on and so on. So there was these rooms, you know, that would take you through the history of magic, the different genres of magic, and you got to see an actual performer perform some of these ideas as they were being explained to you. Mm-hmm. It's a very neat concept. They had a water torture cell, which was a secret room where a diver would actually go into the water being shackled. You got to see all this cool stuff. And then if you paid a little extra money, you got to see me in a private room, in a VIP room, for about 12 to 13 minutes. And basically doing close-up magic. And you have a four-minute reset, and then you do it again for another 13 minutes, and then a four-minute reset. So you get really good at performing and perfecting your craft, because it's literally every 15 minutes you're doing another show for 8 hours. So it was great. So when that was going on, we were also doing COVID testing. So my wife and I had an opportunity with a friend, through a mutual friend, that was testing, doing COVID testing for the film and television business. So we went in there, and we would do, I would do 8 to 4 days, and then I would do Illusionarium, you know, 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. for a whole year. So they're basically nonstop work. So while everyone else wasn't working, we were doing COVID testing and then Illusionarium. And it was pretty crazy. And then they decided to do a real bullet catch. So if you don't know what that is, it's the world's most dangerous magic trick, which is catching a bullet.
Yeah,
very. It's killed 18 people since its inception throughout the years. And they wanted to retweak the show and bring it back bigger and better. So they said, we're going to do a real bullet catch. So I was like, yeah, let me throw my hat in the ring for that. And they were like, yeah, we love this idea. So then I started doing a bullet catch as part of the show. So I would work three different rooms, including the VIP room and the bullet catch room. And then one day I was doing, I think, 12 to 13 bullet catches in a shift, which is already pretty much world record. And then
Nikki's face is describing what's going on in my brain right now, by the way. I'm like, what? Like, I can't tell if you are the most intelligent person I've ever had on the couch.
Can you describe?
Or the craziest.
Can you
like, I can't
a
tell.
Bullet catch for anyone
right.
listening.
Yeah. So bullet catch basically is in this scenario, how it happened was you'd be introduced to the first room, and in that room, there would be a magician performing some close-up magic. Now, during that five-minute set, he'd pull out a bag of 45 caliber bullets, and somebody from the audience would take out a random bullet, autograph the cartridge, and then another person would autograph from the audience would autograph the tip of the bullet, so two different autographs or initials. Then they put the bullet inside of a glass box, which is ribbon tied. And then they themselves take into the next room where they find me in a room on a stage with a 44 caliber Magnum gun that's mounted on one end, me on the other, a little target over here. And then in between me and the gun, there's a steel plate. So I'm wearing a metal glove, kind of similar to the ones you would wear when you're cutting fish.
Okay.
The guys that cut the meat so they don't get cut. So I'm wearing one of those. There's a high speed camera shooting down during the whole thing. And basically, the armory person takes the bullet out of the case in front of everyone, puts it into the gun, fires it through the plate. The plate slows it down just enough for me to catch it in my hand. And then they play back. The bullet goes, and it's obviously the person who signed it can see that it's their bullet.
Right.
And then they play back the video so you can actually see the catch. And you're doing that 12 to 13 times in a show. And then one guy called in sick for his set. So then I had to do 26 in a row with no break. Mm. And then I got the world record for that from that day.
Wow.
That's crazy. Yeah.
So I hold a world record for that. I have another world record for probably the amount of bullet catches I did in a month. But I don't really care about that one. No one's going to be 26 in a day for a long time. So I'll just go with that one.
Right on.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question about working out material.
Yeah.
You hear comedians, they go to clubs, they work out the material.
Right.
You hear Howard Stern just had on the other day, yesterday, Sammy Hager, Joe Satriani, Jason Bonham, and Michael Anthony. And he kept saying the whole time, because they were playing Van Halen songs, nothing but Van Halen songs. They kept saying the whole time, you're actually just allowing us to rehearse.
Right.
Like, we're rehearsing.
Yeah,
we're rehearsing in front of your audience.
Yeah.
What is it with you guys? Because I can imagine, you go to a place and you work it out in front of the audience, or is it a polished thing before you show anybody?
Yeah, it depends on what it is. But typically, a normal average trick, new, ready to go in a show is anywhere between 6 months to 2 years before it's perfect.
Yeah.
But it depends. Sometimes you get something, you get an idea, and it goes in right away, perfect. It fits in with this other thing, and it's like maybe not even a sleight of hand related, maybe it's not even difficult to produce the idea, but sometimes it just drops into place quickly.
Yeah.
But normally it's never quick. Normally it takes a few months to get it to where you want it to be barely presentable enough that you can maybe show a couple guys.
Right.
They get some feedback from them, they throw you some ideas back and forth, and then it's ready for audience testing, and you don't do it a lot. You just drop it in when you think you can,
right?
And then you get confident with it. But sometimes it's like magic. It just works out perfect.
Does it ever bomb? Ever bomb?
Yeah, sure. I mean,
what does a bomb look
I don't want to be, this sounds rude, but I mean, we had a better armory and better safety team than that movie set that what's his name was on. Alec Baldwin, thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so my bullet catch record was the day after Alec Baldwin. Mm. That happened to him. So we had a much better safety team, but that's what, I mean, literally 18 guys have died doing a bullet catch. Yeah. That's how serious that badly could go wrong, it has.
Yeah.
One guy, I think it was in 1600s or 1700s, I forget when, back in the day, 1800s maybe, did the bullet catch, caught his bullet, and then somebody from the audience goes, catch this, and shot him with his own gun and died. That actually happened.
I believe it.
Yeah. So that's, you know, where it could go. Or some guy doing a Russian roulette routine. For some reason, people love to see magicians do dangerous shit.
Hmm.
I don't know why, but it's, you know, it pays, I guess.
I'm not some people, by the way. I'm the person in the audience like this. Like,
good. Yeah,
no,
yeah, yeah.
No.
You don't want us to get hurt.
No, I don't like it.
It's happened. There's a spike routine with, you know, pieces of wood and then one spike, and they all get covered with cups or bags, and you have to like figure out which it's by slamming your hand down on it, and you hopefully don't stab yourself. Tons of guys have stabbed themselves, have stabbed other people, audience members. It happens.
Wow. Yeah. See, because in the back of my mind, I'm always thinking, everything's going to be fine.
You hope so. Yeah, yeah.
This guy knows what he's doing.
Right.
No one's going to get hurt here.
That's me too. Like, I'm so naive. And when I watch illusions and things like that, my thought is always, there's nothing actually dangerous happening here.
Right.
But you're telling me I'm completely wrong and there's tons of dangerous shit happening and somebody could die.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is a certain level of safety that's definitely allowing for the idea, like, you know, for example, a buried alive idea where a guy goes into a box, it's in the middle of the ground, it's days under there and comes back up. Yeah, there's a few different ways you can do that safely. But if anything in the safety goes wrong, you're still screwed. You're still buried under, like, you're under earth. So there's still, you know, other things you have to take into account. Like, I'm not allowed to do a buried alive. Because this one,
by the way, this one is gesturing to the wife.
What do you get out of something like that? What do you get out of something like that?
I don't get a lot about. I'm not one of those guys that loves doing stunt magic and spectacle stuff like that. Because for me, the true test of a magician is what you can do with normal everyday borrowed objects.
Yeah.
With your hands. I know a lot of the big stage stuff. I used to do some stage stuff. I'm not a big. It looks great. It's great. But without a stage, without lighting, without a crew, without the assistant, it's a lot of things can go wrong all the time. Maintenance, there's a trap door could fail. Who knows? It's crazy what could go wrong. So there's a lot of upkeep, storage, all kinds of things that you have to keep. And just because you're a stage illusionist doesn't mean you can do any actual magic.
Right.
So like Houdini was great. he's just synonymous with magic, but mm-hmm. he wasn't a magician. He was an escape artist.
Right, right, right.
He really couldn't do any magic.
Right.
So this is, he was a good promoter. He was a good presenter. Mm-hmm. He knew how to write. He was good that way. But a lot of people don't understand like the difference between what it takes to actually do real magic, you know, with borrowing someone's, you know, ring or coin or something versus here's this special prop that I brought. Here's the special setup that I have. That's a whole different sort of, it's more of a production, more of a
theater. He just segued into like your all-time question. Like, you aren't you always looking for somebody who can explain like David Blaine to you?
Right.
Yeah, but before that,
yeah.
Is there, what do you call the, I was just going to call it a bit. What do you call it? What do you call your the different
effects?
Elements?
Yeah.
Is there anything that you absolutely love to do? Mm-hmm. And is there anything that you hate to do, but you know an audience eats it up?
Oh, that's a great question. I love doing my close-up set. I have a live feed camera that we do in theaters, and it projects on the screen. Everyone can see everything I'm doing. I really enjoy working in theaters. As far as material is concerned, there are certain things that require a lot of setup or can go wrong very easily, like a lot of floating effects or levitation effects mm-hmm. require a lot of not necessarily set up, but pieces of apparatus that could fail. Mm. And if they fail and you're levitating like a Ferrari, you're dropping a Ferrari.
Right,
that's
right,
$250,000. You're just dropping it on a stage. If you're levitating a person or a child and that fails, you're dropping a person. Right. So I like doing them. They look great. But I don't necessarily do them on every show. If corporations book me and stuff like that and they want the full show, yeah, they pay for the full show, great. But you know, if I'm doing a small gathering, I won't bring necessarily the levitation. I'll bring something smaller.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I enjoy doing them, but they're not necessarily need to be done on every show.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, you were saying.
No, I wanted you to ask about David Blaine because that's something you always mentioned.
No, this whole thing just fascinates me. That I'm just completely fascinated by it.
Do you want to see some magic? Apparently, he can do some magic.
Yeah, yeah, we can do some magic. Do you want to get back to this after?
I want to get to that now.
Okay, yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Let's do that.
So
this being his shirt, which right. says "Fuck Miller Fisher," which by the way, I didn't actually realize what that was until you said so.
Really?
Like I had heard of Guillain-Barré, but right. I hadn't heard of Miller Fisher. So I'm learning something along with everybody today.
So I got this. I was in the hospital, and my buddy that visited us, Colin, I'm like, I really want a shirt that says "Fuck Miller Fisher," and then the Miller Fisher to be blurry. And the next day, he got the shirt made, and this is it.
Yeah.
And so one of the first symptoms is blurred vision, double vision. So what were we doing? We were at home and just chilling. Mm-hmm. And then I told the wife, I'm like, I'm feeling a little bit tired. I'm going to go take a nap. And I got up from my nap with double vision and just really weak and head was cloudy. It was just and like two of everything. It was nuts.
Mm-hmm. Had you been sick previously? Like when you said, I'm going to take a nap, were you feeling unwell?
Yeah, just tired. Just tired. Yeah, just a bit just to lay down for a little bit. You know, it wasn't like I felt sick at all.
Okay.
And then when I woke up like that, I'm like, all right, well, maybe we should call somebody. So we called the telehealth nurse or whatever it is. And they asked me a series of questions. And they're like, no, you need to get to a hospital. And I'm like, is there any particular hospital, you know, in Toronto area that you'd recommend? And they were like, no, just get to the closest one as soon as possible and speak to a neurologist. Okay.
Hmm.
So we go and they suspect... The first person had no idea what it was, and then they I guess found a neurologist that might have an idea, and then after about 12 hours or so, they figured out what it could be, which was Miller Fisher. And Dr. C. Miller Fisher is a guy who did all the work that no other doctor would do to find out why people were dying from this particular version of Guillain-Barré. And he went and did brain slices that nobody else had bothered doing in order to determine what was possibly going on. So that's why I got the shirt made, so that people would go, what the hell is Miller Fisher?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't want it, but you should know what it is. Basically, it's a 1 in a million syndrome. One in a million people get it every year. Of the people that do get it, about half have minor symptoms that they don't even realize what they have. It just fades away. Nothing happens to them. And then the other half, if they don't get treated within a couple of days, it's fatal. So what happens is basically first the symptoms is double vision, weakness. That's like day one or two. Then you lose the control of your limbs. Day three, four, five, six, your throat closes and your lungs stop working.
So you went to the hospital as soon as you had the double vision.
Right.
Being that they found somebody who knew what this was.
Right.
Were you able to get treatment so that none of these other symptoms followed, or did you experience any of this?
Oh, yeah, all of them except for the throat closing. So I got very close.
At this moment, I wish Amy was mic'd. Like, were you losing your fucking mind?
She was losing
mind?
Her shit, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So Amy just said he went from double vision to being in a wheelchair within 24 hours.
At the hospital, right.
This is terrifying.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, doing what I do, I couldn't... feed myself. I couldn't walk. I couldn't use my hands, period.
Wow.
Plus I couldn't see. Everything was doubled. So I went from being extremely competent in my physical abilities and my small motor skills to nothing, none of it. So that was extremely terrifying. And, you know, like three MRIs, spinal taps, nerve testing, just, it was an end. I felt like a guinea pig. I felt like this guy has this. We need to do as much testing as we could possibly do to find out anything we can. That's what I felt like. Mm. And, it was nerve wracking. And basically on, I think the third day, they finally got me, one of two or three treatments that were available, because of Dr. C. Miller Fisher. So he figured out a few treatments.
What's the conversation that happens with you guys when you're in the hospital over these days?
The conversation was very, I mean, it was scary, yes, and we're trying to keep positive and try to just, you know, let the doctor do what he needs to do. But, I mean, a lot of the conversation was Amy being my proxy to the staff at the hospital.
Yeah.
Because if I didn't have someone that could speak for me and do decision-making for me, I would have been completely... I don't think it would have went so well. But, like, you know, small things like the staff is overworked. They're tired. They have way too much going on. I understand it's not the best scenario for them. But, you know, they try to give me one of my treatments 24 hours early. Like, it was just because people don't really read everything they should. Mm. It's not their fault. Whatever happens, it happens. But, you know, had Amy not been there to communicate properly of what the doctor's orders were actually supposed to be followed, I don't know what would happen with me if I had nobody. So if you ever do have to go to the hospital, definitely bring someone with you.
Is there a moment in time when you're like, you think, like, I'm going to fucking die?
Yeah, yeah. When I got to the hospital, I thought I was having a stroke. I thought I was having something. And I broke down a few times. Yeah, right at the admission
part. What does a breakdown look like for you? Everyone's breakdown's different. What does yours look
like? Yeah, it was just, you know, thoughts of... I don't have enough time to express, you know, what I want to express to people I love. Like, that's kind of what I went to right away.
Yeah.
You know, I don't have time to, you know, fix relationships or burn, you know, mend the bridges or whatever in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of where I went to right away. So I don't have enough time. That's always been on my mind, you know, throughout the time I've been given is that's it. No more time. Mm. I got to wrap this up.
It sounds so cliche, but this is why, like, almost every single person that I've ever interacted with that's had some sort of near-death experience or thought near-death experience is always thinking about all the things you didn't get to do.
Right.
And this is why, like, everyone always says, like, life is short. Like, don't have regrets. Like, you can't expect that you're going to wake up tomorrow, right? And so every single person that has ever had any kind of near-death experience described exactly what you did. Like, shit, I didn't get to do all of these things. And it's usually the small things. Like, you said apologizing to somebody that you were holding a grudge for.
Stupid.
For what?
Yeah.
Like, stupid shit.
You don't even know why anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Stuff like that. You know, ideas that you wanted to do that you just never got around to doing. Whatever it is, you know. That's kind of where it first went to. And the staff was very... like, just, you know, calm down.
This can sound stupid. Does that make you mad or does that make you sad? Or is, like, what emotion goes with that?
Yeah, a little bit of frustration, but, you know, there's a lot of worry going around as well. Like, so you can't really, you don't have really time to process.
Right.
Because I was going so fast in the wrong direction, I didn't have time to even realize all the things that I couldn't do, because all I could focus on is, I can't even, like, from hour one to hour 10, I could walk, but now I can't.
Right.
I can't go to the bathroom. I can't do nothing. I can't even feed myself. So I'm like, this is going to be, you know, we start, of course you start, you know, well, she starts Googling because I can't even use my hands.
Oh, and that's like the worst thing you can do. Because you go on Google and get all the worst case scenarios, the worst prognosis. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, Googling is, you know, probably making you think
it's
that's
even
it.
Worse,
he's done. Like, there's nothing we can do.
We came across this video of this famous skateboarder or snowboarder. Yeah. I forget his name, but I'm sure we can find him. But so he got diagnosed right after C. Miller Fisher found out how to treat it. So his treatment was experimental still. And this guy, in the same amount of a week, went exact same trajectory, and they put a trach in his throat. They opened up his throat so he could have a pipe to breathe for him. That's how far he got before this experimental drug was available to him. And he was one of the first cases of treatable Miller-Fisher that ended up being, he survived. So because of him, I'm like, oh, fuck, this is where I'm going. That's what I thought. I'm screwed. So, but yeah, it was nuts. It was like 10 days in the hospital and then 3 months of, so as you, once you get treated, it's the reverse. So first you get your legs back. Whatever you lost last, you get back first. Right. So you can start walking again. You can start using your hands again. I couldn't manipulate cards. I couldn't do nothing for like a month. And then for the next 3 months, double vision. So double vision was the last thing to go. And it came back December 24th, 10 days after, or after I went into the hospital. I went in October. That December 24th, I got everything back. I just woke up and it was clear. It was very interesting.
When you come out on the other side of this, you have to be a different person.
Yeah.
You have to be like, I'm going to go about my life like this.
Right.
Does that ever flip back to being, like, does it wear off at some point?
No, not for me, no. I'm sure it would for most people. Right.
Answer this, I want to get clear on the timeline. Sorry, when did this all happen? Like you said, December 24th. December 24th.
That's when I got everything
back.
What
year? I just forgot
last
what year.
Last year?
This was just last year.
Yeah, last year, yeah.
So literally Christmas Eve last year, came back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
And during what, and I didn't tell one of my agents and bookers and the producer, I didn't tell him this was going on. So I had shows lined up to do in November, I think, and like big theater shows, and I can't see shit. So I didn't tell him. And then we were doing Canada's Got Talent. I was helping a buddy of mine do that show. And he met us. My producer came to meet us. He wanted to meet my buddy. So we met at the casino. And that's when I told him what was going on. And he says to me, he goes, why didn't you tell me? I go, you would have pulled all the shows. And he goes, fucking right, I would have. He goes, well, what's going to happen tomorrow's show? I'm like, we'll find out.
You still have double vision at this point.
Right. So
my eyes are looking,
you could literally see my eyes looking in two different directions.
I mean, like there was no bullets at this show, right?
No.
Just to go back, because I'm dying to know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you come out of this and you're like, I'm going to make life changes, I'm going to look at life differently, I'm going to look at relationships differently, I'm going to look at the way I talk to people differently.
Yeah.
Which ones of those things for you stay, and which ones of those things for you fizzle? Like, for example, my father passed away last year, December.
Right.
Right. When that happened, I was like, I was really rethinking relationships and people.
Right.
And it's not until very recently I realized I forgot about some of those things that I committed to. It's like it just faded away.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if that stuff fades away.
I think everybody has a different journey of what's important to them and what, you know, they feel they can do and not do. As long as I think you're still true to at least wanting to be a better person, or it's at least wanting to try to not necessarily fix, but at least correct maybe a path. As long as you have that angst inside of you and you want that for yourself and for other people around you, I think that's as the best you can get. Everybody's failing and no one's perfect.
Right.
Not even me. You know, like I do my best and that's what everyone can do. I don't think there's a better way to go about it. As long as I think you're kind to people, I mean, karma's a currency as far as I'm concerned. It leads to, I think, just being better to other people and better. I mean, as much as crazy as it was to be in the hospital for those days, the staff, as good or bad as they are, it's a messed up environment to be in every day. Like they have to see way worse cases than me, and I'm, you know, I'm going through something where I think I'm going to die, and they still have to be remain calm. Like it's just a matter of perception, I think. You know, if you're always dealing with, you know, like a police officer, a murder detective, you know, these guys see really horrible stuff all the time. Mm. How do you still be positive? You know, you still have to be and have a family and have a career and have children. You know, that I think is way more difficult than what I went through. So I think no matter how bad your scenario is, there's always worse. You know,
how often do you play back the movie?
Oh, I think the first maybe 6 months was focused on recovery.
Yeah.
So the first 2 months was I need to do exercise with my eyes. I need to, like, I couldn't look at screens. There was a bunch of stuff I had to do and couldn't do that would help. And there's no guarantee. So they tell you right off the bat, there's no guarantee. Do what you can. So that's what my focus was on. And then after that, it was, I don't ever want to be in this position again. So what can I do to avoid this? Mm. And this particular scenario, there's no avoiding it. If it happens to you, it happens to you. Right. There's nothing you can do. So at least I know, you know, just keep eating healthy and doing crazy stuff. You'll hopefully live a long time. But you know, there's no.
Does the story ever play back? Do you ever look back to the hospital days?
I don't like looking back at the hospital days.
But it happens
Once in a while. But it's not like I wake up in a cold sweat thinking, oh my god, that day at the hospital. It doesn't really come back that way for me. It's something where I want to forget that feeling of not being able to focus, and like even driving in a car, I couldn't drive, so someone else would always have to drive. But the lines in the road would just intersect. Everything would intersect. Yeah. So that just getting to a place was ridiculous, you know?
So this recount doesn't do anything for you psychologically?
I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, I'm sure it's good to get it out. Right. But I do it
in not a negative way.
It's not a negative way for me. It's more to let other people know that this can happen. And if it does, get to a neurologist as soon as you possibly can. Just, you know, and if you see double vision, definitely call somebody, get to a doctor as soon as possible, get to a hospital as soon as possible. That's the best piece of advice I could get from getting out of this, to let people know this has happened. But as I was saying, the performer, my producer, I started performing with sunglasses on. Mm. So I would go on stage and tell people about Miller Fisher. And I, at the very beginning of the show, and I would start off saying, I'll have to perform my sunglasses on because of all this stuff I went through, and I'm still just recovering, so I have double vision, so I can't really see. And then I quickly realized two things. One was, I would say, ambulances are not cheap, so I need to borrow $100. And I would take a $100 bill from the audience member, and I would change it to a One American and give it back, and there'd be a couple jokes.
Yeah.
So I would get them hooked right away. And the other thing I realized is I could perform my entire act blindfolded, which I didn't realize I could do before. So the muscle memory kicked in. So I was very happy that I could still perform my entire set without having to look at anything. Hmm. So that was partially because of what I did at the VIP room with certain pieces of having to do it over and over and over again, but also having to be forced to be able to do it without looking was huge for me. So now I did the next month and a half of shows with sunglasses on, with the same intro with the bill trick. And then on December 24th, we did a show at Bar Cathedral downtown on the Esplanade. And on that particular show, I told them the story the same as I would. Mm-hmm. And then I said, tonight it's a real miracle, and I just took off the sunglasses because I didn't need them anymore.
Right.
So that was it was one of my best shows. I had full control. It was great. But it came down to doing something so many times that you did not need to see it anymore, which was nice.
That's cool, man.
Yeah. So I learned a lot from having to go through all this, and you know, depending on other people, I have a great group of friends and loyal people around me, and I love them to death, and without them this would have been really, really difficult.
So a year later, physically, do you feel like you did before? Yeah.
Back to normal.
Like no lasting effects, vision, everything.
I'll get a little bit of a twitchy eyelid, but apparently that's stress.
I was going to say, I get a twitchy eyelid. Right. It's just stress. Yeah. I have kids.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that, and that's what the doctor said too. He's like, yeah, it's just, that's nothing. Don't worry about that. So,
you know, this is a really, like, I really hate, I will say, when people try to like put a positive spin on everything, because sometimes there just isn't.
Right.
But like, as you were talking about like things, you know, learning that you could do your whole set blindfolded, I was thinking about like times in my life where I'm like, everything had to fucking go to shit and just crumble for something really, really cool to happen.
Yep.
Okay. And so that's what I was thinking of when you,
if
when you just
if
said
If you
that.
Had to do the trade-off though. Everything going to shit had to crumble for something different, more awesome to grow. Would you have still done that? Presented both? Go through the shit, let it all fall out at the end and something will grow, or just stay on your path and don't worry about
when
it.
You, if you, if I had the choice beforehand, I don't think anybody would choose going to shit.
I'm just asking.
I don't think so.
What if whatever grows comes out a little bit better?
That
would you take that?
See, it would be really hard to know unless you could actually feel that feeling in the future.
You're like guaranteed.
I think if you were
God herself came down from the sky and said
God herself,
it's guaranteed.
I understand, but what I'm thinking of is the logical side of my brain would go, my life is pretty cool right now. Like, I'm an illusionist. I travel the world. I get to do all this cool shit. So do I go through 2 months of tortured physically, emotionally, mentally to get something even better? Or like, am I just pretty happy right now? I guess if you're a super risk taker, you say, sure, God,
right?
I'm doing it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know if given the choice.
Happen, but you know, even, you know what? I think that the majority of people, even if they knew a guarantee, as the devil's advocate would say, I think the majority of people would still choose a safe route.
Yeah.
To be honest with you, it's just easier.
Yep.
You know, people don't, you know, do things like they used to. They don't go to the libraries anymore. They don't, you know, everything is the internet. Everything is searchable. The connection between, you know, face to face conversations is even, I think in the past, it's all it's a screen. That's all it is. For me and my craft, it relies on the interaction. It relies on that moment where I do something that forces a physical reaction in your face, sometimes an emotional reaction, but it's an uncontrollable reaction. And that's my canvas. That split second when that face bursts with emotion, that's my art. That's why I'm here. I know I can do it, and I have multiple ways of doing it, and that's what I do. Anything else I do in my life has nothing to do with you know, that particular part of my craft. And a lot of people, I don't think, realize is that what magic's really about. It's not about what I'm doing, it's how I'm presenting an idea. And if it's presented the right way and it causes you to feel wonder, that's what I'm here to do. That's it. So if I can't do that anymore, I would be really unhappy. You know? So it was a trying moment in my life, for sure.
Do you ever have uncooperative crowds?
Yeah, I love that.
You love
that. How do you deal with an uncooperative? First of all, what is an uncooperative crowd?
A heckler, man.
You?
A heckler.
How do you deal?
You know,
with that?
Someone that thinks they know everything, a little too drunk, maybe, depending on the venue.
Yeah.
You know, typically, so a theater show, you got like, you know, anywhere between 300 to 400 or 500, maybe even a couple thousand. We've done shows up to 3,000 people. Typically, those shows, the audience knows what they're coming to see. They've paid for tickets. So typically, those crowds are very non-heckler.
Yeah.
But when you go do like bars or like Yuck Yucks or these kinds of comedy clubs, you know, you do a comedy magic set for 15, 20 minutes. Yes, they're going to be hecklers for sure. And I love hecklers. You know, and the guys will be, you know, they're just too drunk or they're belligerent or whatever. I have so many heckler lines to come back and control the situation.
Right.
And that only comes from doing a lot of shows where you're trying stuff out. Like you were saying earlier, heckler responses. These things only come with experience, because you get to realize, you know, how you can massage the situation in your benefit, but still
massage.
Yeah, thank you. They got it. You know, it's and I think that's, again, comes back to studying people and knowing how to deal with people in a and you don't want to seem overbearing, but you want to be able to go, basically, I do the jokes here, type of thing. You know, I'm the one that's presenting, so just behave, type of thing. It's kind of the idea you can have, but at the same time, it's not to say that your opinion doesn't matter. It's just not maybe reasonable to state it during a show. You know what I mean? So, you know, don't ruin it for everyone else, type of thing. These are kind of the basic ideas. But I mean, you have some guys that are just bastards about it, and you have to be more direct. Mm. You know. With these kinds of, but there's a lot of ways to deal with you, and I enjoy it. A lot of guys don't. A lot of guys will like freeze or don't have comebacks, so they'll just try to like continue with the normal set that they were doing. And I'm like, no, you take that's an opportunity. You have to roll with that.
Right, right, right.
You have to run with that. You have to, you know, do something about that.
Is it like a little bit satisfying to like shut a heckler
oh,
up?
Yeah.
Like,
oh, it's the best. Especially when you got the rest of the crowd on your side because of them. That's even better.
Yeah.
That is the ultimate cake. I was like, you know what? Like one time we were doing a show and I think this was Bar Cathedral as well. Some dude, because the way the place was set up, there was an ice crusher machine. I guess they make the smoothie margaritas with this machine or
right,
whatever
right, yeah.
in the back of the whole place. It's a loud crushing machine. So halfway through the set, this obviously server had to make this drink and they started the machine. I'm like, really? Right now? That now you want to do it? So they stop. And then, like, a few seconds later, they turned it on again. I'm like, now you're just fucking with me. It's, you know, like that kind of stuff. So, but you gain the audience at the same time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's definitely the way you handle it is to always get the audience on your side. And, you know, if the guy's drunk, it's easy. But a lot of guys, you know, don't have that experience because they haven't been doing it forever. They focus too much on theory, practice, and not getting out there. And that's, I tell guys a lot. So one of the biggest pieces of advice I give to magicians is put yourself in uncomfortable situations. Hmm. Perform in uncomfortable situations. That's the only way you'll get better. It's not about technique. It's not about anything else. It's just about how you handle yourself in front of another person that you wouldn't normally handle yourself with, like, you know, bikers or something. You know, I had this crazy biker story performing for the bikers, and that was an interesting experience for sure. Yeah, that's a whole nother story.
Yeah. You're laughing already. You haven't
even
heard the story.
I can only imagine.
It was pretty crazy.
We're all just sitting here like, so, bikers?
I can just imagine him performing for Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah. So, you know how they have like a clubhouse and they all hang out? Yeah, okay, yeah. So I got invited, friend of a friend of a friend of a friend. You got to come up and do some magic at the clubhouse. Sure. So they're having a barbecue. We go in and there's like, you know, security checkpoints to get into this compound. It's all gated in. And they say to me, you never been here before? I'm like, no. And they know I've never been there before.
Yeah.
And they go, okay, look, you know, just, you know, stay in front of the bar. Don't go behind the bar and ignore the wolf. I'm like, what?
The wolf.
And we just fed the wolf. He's walking around. Just ignore him. Don't even look at him. I'm like, okay, sounds like reasonable advice. Get inside. Sure enough, there's a fucking wolf walking the perimeter of this fence. I'm like, this is too much. Yeah,
no.
Yeah, yeah. So then we go inside and, you know, we're doing magic, whatever. And then this I'm on this tabletop and I have this little mat. I'm doing card tricks. And I look up and there's a huge belly just covered in tattoos. And just the meanest, drunkest biker you've ever met.
Why was his belly out in the bar?
It's their
he's
clubhouse.
A biker and he can do whatever he wants.
It's a summer, yeah.
They got a fucking wolf.
Yeah, okay. They have a wolf. They have barbie. It's crazy. Anyway, so it's just massive belly, just covered in tattoos. And he's belligerent. He's drunk as fuck. And he goes, show me a trick. Okay, so I'm like, pick a card. He takes a card and I'm like, here, sign your name on it. He signs his name on it and he throws back the marker. And we put the card in the deck. It gets lost. And eventually the card comes out of my mouth folded up. Mm. And I take it out and I unfold it so the signature is facing him so he can verify, in fact, it's his card. He rips it out of my hand and he goes, fuck me, fuck you, fuck me. And he turns it around. He wrote fuck you on the card. But then he pulls down his lip and on the inside of his lip, he had tattooed fuck you. I was like, okay, I think I should go now. That was enough for me. And then I think like a few weeks later, they found him in the back of a trunk somewhere. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, in Montreal, I think. So yeah, I never went to do that show again. So
what would make you take that show in the first place?
Yeah, that was again. This was not a you know money show. This was just friend of a friend.
Yeah.
And they thought it would be a good idea. it was interesting. Good story.
Your friend that was the friend is still your friend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're still okay. Around. They're all good. They're good.
Did they know about the fucking wolf? Like, did anybody know
me.
They were throwing you
they
literally into the wolves?
Me. They could have told me that if they did know. That's a great question. I should find out and get back to them on that.
I might have just caused an argument between friends. Sorry.
But yeah, there's a lot of interesting stories like that, you know, traveling around and doing magic. I got a chance to go to India and for business. And I get, after like 16, 18 hours of travel, get to the hotel. And I'm like, can I get two Coronas and a bottle opener and a bucket of ice? They're like, what is a Corona? I'm like, okay, what's your most popular beer? They're like, Kingfisher. I'm like, great. Two Kingfisher, bucket of ice, bottle opener. They're like, okay, so they come upstairs And they go, okay, that's like, 40 rupee or 50, whatever it was. And I go, okay, do you have 100 rupees? And they go, yeah. I go, okay, give me 100 rupees. And they're looking at me like, why would we give you, you got to give us money. I'm like, trust me, just give me the money. So they give me 100 rupee and I change it to 1,000 rupee and I give it back to them. Now that's a huge tip. I go, tomorrow I want 2 Corona, a bucket of. So for the next 9 days, every time I go back to the hotel, bucket of ice, 2 Coronas and a bottle opener.
It's great.
That's cool, man.
Yeah. So yeah, it's a good. I've enjoyed the time I've had. It's been good.
This is so fun. Like a passionate 5 years old has turned into a whole career.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting because you know how like
who needed to go to school.
Well, you know how there's a lot of talk about like, you know, kids think they can do whatever they want because their parents tell them they can do whatever they want.
Yeah,
but
no.
I mean, in some circumstances, can take something fun and do whatever you want.
But that was not my life experience. My life experience was not that. My parents didn't say, you could be whatever you want. That's not what happened.
Were they like, can get a real job?
Yeah. So I had a real job the entire time up until a few years ago. I've done every job you could imagine. Every job in the restaurant, every job, sprinkler installation, security, driver. I've done every job in the restaurant, management, every sales position. I've sold websites, SEO, pay-per-click. I've done it all. I'm good at sales, especially on the phone. But I if I hadn't done all these things, I wouldn't be able to produce my own material, produce my own content,
right.
Be able to plan out, projects and complete them. It had nothing to do with school. School is not where you learn these types of things. But because of the network that you create, hopefully by, making relationships along the way, you meet like a really good mechanic. You meet like a really good guy that's in the AV business that can mm-hmm. help you out. You meet like people that, support you along the way. And that doesn't come from an education. That education is life. That's hitting the streets and doing it.
Yeah.
I love my parents, but they weren't like, yeah, magic's a good choice. Not the case. But it was interesting because after I started performing in my by the time I was like mid-20s, almost in my 30s, then it became, at family functions, it was like, oh, Ken, come perform. Yeah. Show off, our son. It's amazing. Yeah. What happened to the lead up to get to hear mom and dad? It wasn't always, supportive. So I envy guys that, went to magic camp, went to magic school. I never had any of these opportunities.
But maybe you're better for it.
I think so. Yeah. I think it's
when you were growing up, was magic cool? I know it's cool to you, but was magic cool to all of your.
It wasn't. Okay. So it wasn't like David Blaine, Chris Angel.
Right.
Cool back then.
Right.
It was cool because it was just magic, but it wasn't because David Blaine was the first guy that showed the reactions of magic in a street kind of setting, in a normal setting. And that allowed people to think, wait, magic is possible everywhere, not just on a stage classically presented, coattails and top hat.
Right.
Right. So I think that brought the coolness of magic to a larger audience amount of people that could see it and enjoy it. But also what was really turning was the idea of showing the reaction, which is the canvas. That would never been done before. Mm. It would be a couple of quick shots, but this is over and over.
When you're 7 doing magic, are your friends like, oh, fucking nerd doing magic over there?
At 7, they'd probably think it's cool.
Yeah,
a little older.
I don't know.
I never had a problem with there might have been people that talked shit in the back. I don't know.
Right.
But, I had no problem with girls or. I was an interesting fellow.
Is he saying magic gets you laid?
100%. 100%. Yeah.
Really?
Half the reason you get
it. If you just go to a bar now, like, I'm a magician. Like,
so I used to do this joke where.
Remember Amy?
Yes. She's right here. So I used to do this joke with. I used to do this joke with a deck of cards. I go, honestly, if you walk up to any girl as a male with two things, a deck of cards and a Sharpie marker, and just open the deck of cards, have her pick a card, give her the marker, and ask her to write down her phone number. I am not kidding. 63% of the time, they'll give you the real phone number.
I'm in that 63%. I would definitely do it. Because like I said, I look at magic and I'm like, show me.
63% of the time.
To be honest, it does. Because first of all, they don't know what you're about to do.
Mm.
So it's not like, that's another great thing about magic. Is so they're like, okay, my phone number. Now what? I'll call you later. Like they have no idea what you're about to do with it, right? They just lost their phone number. So
thanks. I'm gonna put this in my phone.
I'll add to the other 220 I got tonight. And I got to go buy a new deck now. And
But, are you kidding? You got a billion in the car.
I do, yeah. the other good thing about Magic is that that's exactly it, is that and comes with experience and learning as well, is that if you're a musician and you sing a song that people know and like, you deviate from that way that they like it, they know. You miss a line, a word, a phrase, know. And they're like, oh, this is not. They instantly, this Magic is not like that. They have no idea what they're about to see or what comes next, right? So even if they've seen the show a few times and something like comes up, you, as a professional, you have outs. You have different ways to go in case things go wrong. So it's almost part of the fun is you know, when do I get to use these outs? Because I have stacked of outs. So when they're ready and shit happens, time to use this one. So that's what's different about Magic, is that they don't know what to expect.
By the way, the only props that Ken has here on the table is a deck of cards and a Sharpie.
Yeah, just going to score numbers. Exactly.
Now I know the trick.
When you're watching other artists do their thing, is it genuine enjoyment?
Yeah.
Is there any part of this like, this guy fucking sucks, I can kick his ass?
It's not a competition for me. It's more like I either do or don't like their presentation.
Okay.
The technique is 99%, 98% of the time I know what they're doing.
Right.
It's a bummer for me because I don't get to be fooled very often.
Yeah.
At this level, but
so you watch it to be fooled.
I love, if I could see a trick that I don't know, I'd please.
Did you watch the Penn and Teller show where they try to get magicians to fool them?
Fool us?
Yeah.
I'm not allowed on that show.
Of course, you're not allowed on the show.
No, I'm not allowed. I submitted.
No, but I would say of course you wouldn't be allowed.
Yeah.
No,
they responded like,
because didn't you work with them?
You're a professional magician.
Yeah.
I get it.
So yeah, get this. Okay, so to be on the show, you submit a video of a trick that you want to think you can befool them.
Yeah.
And at the time of submission, this is right before Illusionarium. At the time of submission, it was Johnny Thompson, who was fucking genius. I loved him. He was one of my idols. And this other producer, I won't mention his name. Anyway, so I submit my trick with video. Johnny Thompson has no idea what I'm doing, which tells me I'm on the right track. Because if I can fool Johnny Thompson with my own original idea, that's a magician fool that I've been doing for years, this is good vibes. So then the other producer guessed wrong. And then he says, send me a video of how you do it so I can make sure that Penn and Teller don't know your theory.
Mm.
I'm like, isn't that the point of going on the show?
Yeah.
Right. So I'm like, this sounds like a little bit of BS. So I'm like, okay, why don't we do this? Why don't I put the secret in an envelope, and if they guess right.
Mm-hmm.
And if they guess wrong, we can go to the envelope. You know, no problem. Right. I can prove that they're wrong. They won't do that. So that tells me, just like every other, that's why I won't do Canada's Got Talent, Britain's Got Talent. I won't do any of these big shows because of the contract of perpetuity. We own what you do for perpetuity throughout existence, throughout the universe.
Mm.
Illusionarium purposely excluded that part of the clause in the contract. They purposely said, yes, share whatever you want. You don't have to worry about anything. We want you sharing your socials. They were very open. And I said, okay, that show I will do. And I beat out 400 other guys doing that.
I thought you couldn't go on because of Illusionarium, but this came before
this
that.
This was before, yeah. And now I have something even better that I could probably fool them with, most likely. It's totally mine. It's never been seen. But, I think that's just comes down to production of television, reality TV. It doesn't matter, you know, again, what you do. It's, do we have too many people that got fooled this season? Okay, well, then, you know, they're all in earpieces anyway. So what's the point? You're not actually fooling them. It doesn't make sense. It contradicts the show. So I get it that they're doing it for TV. I fully respect that. They're good magicians. Fantastic. But the premise and the actual going through it is just like any other reality TV show, which I don't really think is good for Magic.
Meeting your idols, good or bad for you?
Interesting. The last couple of years, we've done a lot of theater shows, got to meet a lot of magicians. I've been graced with meeting some of the guys I've watched throughout the years, and it's been good so far. You know, everyone that's been very gracious and very welcoming, in the bigger sense of the Magic community, in the world sort of international community, not so much locally, but as soon as you go outside of your comfort zone, they've been very, very gracious and very, very good. I haven't had any sort of conflict with any of them. It's been great. And they've been very sort of generous with their information and can you give me a testimonial? It's been great. It's been so awesome. We just launched this club52.ca and the WOW Foundation. So The WOW Foundation is the World of Wonder Foundation, and it's it helps people that are underserved in the community, women especially, other magicians, kids that can't afford magic. Basically, anyone that wants to do magic that can't have the access to mentorship or props because they are expensive, we provide all that. So guys that I've met along the way have jumped on board onto this idea and are providing mentorship and providing some of their tricks to these kids and videos and things of that nature. I'm sure. I mean, you have a pretty organized studio, but I'm sure you got a box somewhere full of cable.
Yeah,
broken cables. He does, but his cables are organized.
Right, but like cables you don't need, don't want.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah.
So we have, you know, have you heard cards for kids? Have you heard this thing on the radio? Mm-hmm. Cards, you yeah. Same thing, but for kids for magic. So cables for kids. So we go around, we pick up all the copper cable, and we recycle it, and the money goes to sponsorship for these children as well. Mm.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Everyone should do magic.
I think so. You know, make people smile instead of frown. It's a good thing.
Can we see magic now?
Yeah.
Last question. I won't bug you anymore. If someone that knows nothing about magic, which is me, stumbles across your office 30 years from now and sees all this shit, will I know it's magic that's happened with all this stuff, or would I be like, what the fuck is all this?
Oh, fuck. So my office, you would know all the AV stuff.
Yeah.
So all the cabling, all the lighting, you would know all that stuff.
Yeah.
But funny story, one day my cousin was at, we were living together at the time, and he picked up a deck of cards and decided to play poker with it. It was not a regular deck of cards. And he proceeded to completely fuck up a week's worth of work because he just wanted to play poker. And I'm like, did you not notice it's just not a regular deck of cards? He's like, So, yeah, I mean, there are definitely, like the casino story, these guys didn't know what this one piece was inside of an incense tube.
Yeah, because I'd imagine I stumble into your office, I'd be looking at all this shit, I'd be like, what the fuck is this guy do?
Yeah.
No clue.
You're either thinking like kinky as fuck, dangerous as fuck, is this a terrorist? Like, what am I dealing with here?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, I build my own gimmicks and props. I have a breadboard for electronic testing. I have a sound gear, audio gear, like just a video gear. I drone. I do a bunch of different things.
Wow.
You know, I just set up my podcast with the exact same microphone stand. And I have the headphone. Yeah. Everything's sort of coming together now.
He's got all the toys.
Yeah, pretty much. And then I got rid of a lot of toys because I had no room for them anymore. I think you would like my office. I think you would.
Enough of answering my bullshit questions. Let's see some shit.
Yeah, no, I can narrate what's happening. Let people know. I'm gonna watch the magic, guys. Sorry that you can't see it.
You guys can shoot, and then you can just share the video, and then you guys have both.
All right, let's see what's gonna happen. So he's got his deck of cards and Sharpie.
We're gonna do something. We'll put that here for a second. Halloween just kind of happened, right?
Yeah, Halloween just happened. Just not that long ago.
So we'll do something. We can do this here. What we're going to do is, let's do this.
See, by the way, when he fumbles and drops a card, my brain is like, was that part of it? Is that part of it? Did he mean to drop that card? Should I have paid attention to that card?
No, that's fine. All right, just take one out for me.
All right, I am pulling out a card. Am I showing anybody? Or
no, you don't have to. You can show the camera if you like.
Yeah.
Right. All right, I will.
Do that one too. Oh, wait.
Wait, because he can see.
I will look at that one.
Yeah.
Everybody else, can you see this? Mark, can you see this?
On the TV? Yeah, you can kind of. You can see it if you try hard enough.
So,
okay.
I'm going to give you the marker.
Uh-huh.
So what you do is I want you to take the marker and I want you to autograph your name or draw a picture.
On the face?
Yeah, like, okay. Or gang tag, whatever.
Or gang tag. Okay.
All right.
Am I giving you back this card
now?
Yeah,
did you put your credit card number or PIN number?
I sure did. Awesome. Yeah, all my social insurance number, it's all there.
So there's two reasons why we have someone autograph a playing card. Well, why I have them autograph. Number one, it keeps you honest. You commit to a card. After, you know, a few drinks, some people get clever and go, that's not my card. I'm not saying you're one of them, but it happens, right? So it commits you to one card. It also does another thing. It creates a unique piece of art. So unless you go around the world autographing Blue Bicycle 808 decks, which I highly doubt you do, this should be the only card in the world that looks like this,
right?
So the idea is that, what's it called? We'll cut this maybe halfway, just a little bit there. We'll put that in the center. Now, the idea is that Halloween just passed, and Halloween could be one of those creepy kind of times if you believe in ghosts and that sort of stuff, right? So your card somewhere in the middle of the deck. And the idea is We find your card in a very creepy way.
All right, he's spreading out all the cards. My card, which I have autographed, is somewhere in the middle of the deck. And he got it.
That's cool shit, man.
So, yeah, so for you guys at home, sorry, you didn't get to see any of that, but I did, in fact, sign a card. It was the King of Spades, and first he just pulled it out of nowhere. Don't know how that happened. And then he used the shadow of his finger to separate the cards, and mine just popped out. So, ghosts, maybe.
Maybe.
Magic,
that's why I do
maybe.
It for Halloween, right? This is more of a direct approach as far as gambling cheats are concerned. Are you left-handed or right-handed?
I'm right-handed.
Okay, go like this with your right hand. And put your left hand on your wrist, just like this. Perfect. Now come a little closer. We'll take your autograph card, and I'll put it right on top of your palm, face down. Put your other hand on top like a sandwich. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't matter. As long as you know where it is, I can't mess with it. Next card I have on top is six of hearts. You have the autograph card, yeah? A little bit of, just got to keep your eye on the six. You know where the autograph card is, right? I have the autograph card now.
No,
look
he
inside,
doesn't.
Look
no,
inside
he doesn't.
Your hand.
How the fuck did you do that? I got the six of hearts in my hands. Okay. I'm going home now.
Now that might have been.
That's.
I get that a lot. People just run.
That was like I saw a video. I guess I think David Blaine was in Harrison Ford's house and
yes,
he did a trick.
Get the fuck
and Harrison
out of my
Ford
house.
Just get the fuck yeah. out of my house.
Yeah. Yeah. He made his sign card come out of a lemon or something. That might have been too fast. That's what my wife says. Anyway, she doesn't say that anymore.
That's what
I
she
put
said.
My hand in her mouth. She loves it. Anyway, here we go.
I told you I've got a chronic cough. You can't make me laugh like that.
Sorry. That, by the way, that series of jokes was developed way over time and experience. So autograph card. I'll put it down for a moment.
Okay.
Just say stop whenever you like.
Stop.
All right. We'll put that right there in the middle. And just back on top. We'll get your card again.
Of course you will.
Now, I mean, if that is too fast, I mean, sometimes really all you need is a couple seconds. You can change it if you wanted to change it to a different card entirely. If you want to change it back, you could, of course, do that again with a couple seconds. You can even do this with one hand. Just drop the rest of the cards on top until you're left with one card on top.
The
which
fuck
is
am I
card.
Watching, guys? I'm really glad that Amy's getting all of this because I need you guys. Like, we got to share this video when we share the podcast,
yeah,
so you guys can see what's happening here.
So I pushed it, a few
in
cards.
I see my card. Yeah,
your card's there. Now this time, instead of me pushing it in, I want you to go ahead and push it all the way in yourself. Go for it.
Okay.
Look in my mouth.
No, stop it.
That's a good card. So I'm going to show you a couple of things why nobody will play cards with me. We'll leave that aside for a moment. So in poker, most card games, but poker is a pretty common game, and one of the most highest valuable hands in poker is four aces. It's not the highest, but it's really up there. Most guys that get four aces in a game would probably go all in. They put the house, the kids, the wife, the car, everything, because it's a really good hand to have. So shuffle deck of cards. I'm going to show you why nobody will play cards with me. I had this ability to find aces whenever I want just by shuffling and cutting the deck as I go. That's number two. Number three and number four get a little bit more difficult as we go. I believe that's number three. There we go. Last one is always the most difficult. It just is three of hearts. Oh. We're okay.
Wow. He just pulled all four aces out of the deck. No big deal.
No big deal.
Just any other Thursday.
Yeah. Is it Thursday? It's good. Anyway, four aces. We'll simplify. We'll get rid of all the cards. We'll just use four aces. This time we'll use a marker. Just put both hands out. Just both hands nice and flat like a table. Yeah. And let's try this here. First ace on top, ace of hearts. We'll put that on your left hand. All right, little shuffle. Next one on top, ace of diamonds. Perfect, the reds. So I have you hold on to your right hand as a diamond and the heart, right? Now we're going to switch them very quickly. Did you see how fast that was?
Jesus Christ.
So now Mark is not holding the ace of diamonds and ace of hearts. What's
Let's
in your
see what
hands?
You got, man.
Nope, that would be the ace of spades and ace of clubs.
That's fucking cool, man. Super
check your pocket.
Cool.
Check your pocket.
It's like, wait just a minute.
So yeah, it's a bit of close up stuff that I do.
I like it.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's fun. Good at bars. It's great. But it's a good way to meet people. And I always leave someone with the souvenir. They can keep it forever.
Oh, yay. Yeah, I get to keep my signed card.
How often do you come
that was
with
in Ken's
stuff?
Mouth.
Yeah. Yeah, my DNA. New stuff is, I'm always, always researching, always looking. You know, there is a lot of you know, stuff on the market that comes out. I mean, back in the day, a really good trick would come out maybe once every 6 months.
Yeah.
And now it's like every week there's like 10 different things to look at. But a lot of them are like knockoffs, not knockoffs, but reimaginations of old ideas,
right,
and old tricks. And as technology gets better, magicians are basically the first to sort of adopt technology and use it in a new way that may have not have been thought of before,
right,
but not because of the technology, not for that necessarily that purpose that technology was designed for, but how can I use this new technology in magic?
Mm.
And that's typically what happens with a lot of magic, is that guys just get a hold of technology and go, wait, this would make this effect way better. You know, and that's a lot of what's happening now is reworkings of old ideas. But I'm always looking to, again, like I'm always watching magic. My feed is all magic related. All the groups are magic. I get tons of invites to all kinds of stuff all the time. There's magic conventions. There's, you know, private guys. Like I have this one good friend in California and West Coast who builds a lot of my custom card gimmicks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a killer. He's a monster when it comes to these custom gimmick, really intricate pieces of work. And they are pieces of art, but they do really immaculate things. But guys like that, I know tons of magicians that have like, oh, my guy does this, and my guy, you know, everyone has their own person that takes care of whatever.
Mm.
But it's nice that over the years, like I've never even met this guy in real life.
That's sweet,
you know. But we have intimate conversations over many years. You know, we still haven't met. Like that. That's what's great about the internet and technology now, is the idea of sharing from so large distances. I can't imagine what it was like before. It would be so take forever.
Mm. Well, speaking of the internet and sharing, if people are listening, like,
yeah, sure,
is there a way people can find you, follow you, like where you perform? I guess guaranteed people are going to listen to this and say, like, I need to see this guy.
Yeah. So we do corporate shows. We're available for bookings, Christmas parties, weddings. We do it all. I'm even doing a memorial party for a celebration of life party next week or this week. We're doing London Theater Wolf Performance Hall this tomorrow. Oh, that's London tomorrow. So we're doing that tomorrow. But KenMargo.com is the main website. At KenMargo is the Insta, I guess. And basically the club52.ca is the second website, and we're listed on a bunch of other websites for different events, but we're definitely available for corporate bookings. We're available for all kinds of different ideas. So
what do you wear when you perform?
On set?
Yeah.
On shows? Yeah, it depends. Depends on what I'm doing, but typically it's pants. Typically, not always. Yeah, not always. Like I can perform in a pool if I had to, but typically, yeah, pants and a pair of really cool docks and a t-shirt and a dress shirt and a jacket. I go pretty. I don't go pretty. You know, I don't do the coattails or I don't have like this really really alter ego where I, you know, tattoo. I don't do any of that stuff. I try to be. I don't even like wearing jewelry.
Hmm.
So for me, it's like people will suspect something if it's there. So for me, I think it just take away as much as possible.
Right.
So I try to have very little on my appearance or what I look, so that the focus is solely on what's going on.
See, it's any other Thursday.
Nice.
Ken shows up as Ken.
That's it.
I like it.
It's perfect.
This is fun, man. This is fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was very different from the episodes we usually do. Thanks to Nikki, our regular, who said, do I have a guest for you?
Yeah, yeah. And you guys should totally come to a show next time around. I will give you tickets for sure.
Absolutely. I'm in. Look how amazed I was.
2 seconds.
It looks like the microphone's going to Nikki to do the outro.
Thanks, Ken. Do you have any idea how hard it was to sit on that couch and not talk?
You did so good. You did so
magic
good.
Magic in itself. Well done.
Are you going to take us out, Nikki?
Ken Margo. KenMargoe.
That's correct. Yeah. Yep.
All right. You guys have been listening to Two Massage Therapists and a Microphone. Peace.